This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
Fridays and Saturdays through June 24th at the Axiom, 2524 McKinney. For reservations, call 713-522-8443. This is KPFT Houston.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices. And it is Monday, May 29th, of an evening where we have had some storms and even some flooding along in North Houston. And if you look outside at the sky there this evening, it's kind of overcast, and that's because there's another storm center that's down. Well, if you drew a line between Victoria and Bryan College Station, there was a storm center kind of along a line demarked by that line, that imaginary line. Not moving very fast, but the outflow at upper levels from that is kind of coming over Houston and making it overcast. And we're told that it may even rain or storm again this evening before all is said and done. But we are here, and I'm Glenn.
I'm Jennifer Renee.
And J.D. Doyle.
And so I guess what we're going to do first, while we get some of the other stuff loaded up, is we're going to play some Pride music. J.D., you want to say a word about that?
Yeah, I do. We got a number of Pride artists for the festival this year, very good ones. And I put together a CD, so we'd have that music handy. And the one we're starting out with tonight is by K.J. Dennert.
This is Queer Voices.
And again, that was KJ Dennert. I love what she did with the Beatles song, She Loves You. Now we've got in the studio, we're going to talk about chorus music, and we have an expert with us. Right, Kenneth?
That's right, I suppose.
Well, what's your name?
Kenneth Claiborne.
Yes. And what organization are you with?
I am with Bayou City Performing Arts. Actually, we are part of a Gay Men's Chorus Houston, Bayou City Performing Arts, which also incorporates the Bayou City Women's Chorus. But we have a great show coming up for Pride.
Do you really? When are y'all performing?
We are performing on Saturday, June the 10th. It's going to be the closeout of our final season, the final show of our season for Winds of Change. We're going to close out with our Pride show, and it's going to be a big thing. You know, we like doing things big down here in Texas, and we've invited the Turtle Creek Chorale from Dallas to come down, and they're going to do the concert with us. And it's going to be a spectacular moment in Jones Hall.
Well, I saw that. Turtles on the Bayou.
They are a very well-respected group nationally in the gay chorus movement.
Yes, they are.
How'd you get them down here?
Well, actually, I don't know if you remember from before. Last year, we were fortunate enough to go to Dallas. Dallas hosted all of the Texas choruses, and that was a great deal to have San Antonio and Austin, Houston and Dallas, and at the Myers Center down there at the Meyerson Symphony Center. And we thought it would be just great for Houston to do the same thing. And it just so happens that they are going to come down for our Pride show and just make it one big family event.
And where is it going to be?
This is
going to
be at Jones Hall on Saturday, June the 10th at 8 o'clock.
Well, how do you rehearse something like this when they're in Dallas and y'all are here?
Well, actually, what we're going to do is we have music. We're going to do part of the show. They will do part of the show. We will do combined numbers. The numbers that we do combined, they have rehearsed by themselves. We rehearse by ourselves. Then it's going to make for a very long Saturday morning.
Oh, you do get together before the show.
Yes, there will be lots of time.
That's encouraging.
Camaraderie okay. after we welcome them on that Friday.
Sorry, no, here in Dallas, we do it in this key.
And it's pick a song. Yeah, everybody does a line. No, but it's going to be a very long day. But we will have lots of time together on Saturday.
How do you pick the material for something like this? Dallas has their favorites that they chose, and y'all the same thing?
Right. There's a lot that goes on in here. When you get into choosing material for Pride, there's a lot that you want to cover. There's a lot that each director wants to cover. Dr. Seelig from Dallas, along with James Knapp, the artistic director here in the city. And you just lay them all out, and you try and give a nice, diverse set of music for the listeners to cover all arenas that we're
so you try and get some classical or some Pride music, or how do you approach it?
Actually, since this is the Pride concert, we try to focus a little bit more on Pride and empowerment and enlightenment. Also, we are going to focus on American composers and composers within the GLBT community. It's a fun thing to do, to just find wonderful music that's going to make a point of saying who we are and who we represent.
Who are some of the GLBT composers y'all have picked?
Eric Lane Barnes.
Oh, yes.
We're doing some arrangements from Dennis Coleman, who is the artistic director from Seattle. Mm-hmm. So we are representing the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender community, as well as American composers.
Yes, I interviewed Eric Lane Barnes about a year ago on my Queer Musical Heritage show because just he is such an outstanding outstanding writer of choral music, and that genre needs to be brought to the front, too.
Yes. Also, David Maddox, along with him.
Right,
we're
in
doing
Seattle.
Some wonderful mm-hmm. David Maddox. As a matter of fact, David Maddox did the arrangement for the 70s show, which was the show that we had in March. I hope that the listeners had a great time at that show. That was a wonderful time in Jones Hall.
Have you picked a personal favorite from the show?
Yeah. There are so many. We're trying to do so many things here. We're actually probably for good from Wicked, the Broadway musical, mm-hmm. Which is such a beautiful text of a person being in another person's life and then those persons having to separate. And the text goes on to say mm-hmm. that since you have been in my life has been changed for good. So probably that, a very, very meaningful song.
And the organization now, is it just recently that you became Bayou City?
Yes. When we took on the ladies, we had to...
When you added the ladies. You didn't take them on.
Well, actually, that's true. I don't know. We probably would lose that.
Smackdown. Smackdown at Jones Hall.
But we had to broaden the scope of what we were all about in incorporating everyone into just what you would see when you look at our general publications, Bayou City Performing Arts, which is representative of the Bayou City of Houston. Mm-hmm. It is not only the gay men's chorus, but it is also the Bayou City women's chorus. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to choose an appropriate name that would cover mm-hmm. both organizations.
What other cities have done that sort of umbrella type organization?
Dallas has done that. Usually your larger cities, mm-hmm. New York, I'm quite sure. Hartlett has done it.
Chicago has a big organization.
Yes. You all want to be a part of and not apart from, if I'm going to borrow from mm-hmm. a past pride statement. So it was easy to do and difficult to do, but we wanted to bring us all together, showing unity.
Well, this should give you an opportunity to add other choral groups, you know, to that umbrella. Like, for example, small ensembles.
That is right.
Have you pursued that at all?
That is right. That is on the drawing board.
Good.
We're looking at that. Again, Dallas and a number of other cities do have smaller ensembles.
Seattle does that very well.
Yes, which are able to go out into the community mm. and represent. Sometimes when you aren't able to take your entire course, then you're able to also do different styles of music, mm-hmm. Which is also more fun.
Sometimes the music itself is more fun.
Right, with a smaller group.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, it's more liberal. I'm at the loss for the way of describing it. More comical, perhaps, sometimes.
Oh, you can push the envelope, and I'm always one for pushing the envelope.
All right.
It always seems like you can get away with a lot more with a smaller group than you can with your larger chorus.
Mm. Well, how would they get in touch with you? We haven't talked about that.
Well, actually, we have a website. Our website is www.BayouCityPerformingArts.org.
That's a mouthful.
www.BayouCityPerformingArts.org, or they can call 713-521-7464, and that's 521-SING. And we also rehearse every Monday night at Covenant Church in the Museum District, but the men's chorus is about to go on our summer hiatus until the beginning of the season, the fall season for the next.
Now, does the women's chorus rehearse at the same time?
Actually, the women rehearse on Tuesday night at MCCR at 7 o'clock, all which can be found on the website. But they are still getting ready. Unfortunately, the women will not be singing with us on this concert. We kind of
miss
them.
Yeah. This year.
Yes, because they are getting ready for their own big blowout coming up in June.
They've had their debut performance, though, already, right?
Yes, their debut performance was the last performance singing with us, and the women's chorus is just taking off greatly, and they are excited, and we are excited.
Now, what are they performing in June?
They are performing a number of things. The name of their concert concert is taking center stage, and that's exactly what they're going to do. And the, as a matter of fact, the June 17th concert is sold out. So we've added a second concert on Tuesday, June the 20th, at a beautiful Bering Methodist Church.
That's a good size hall to sell out. That's good.
Yes, and it's very good, and we're on the way to selling out the second show.
Wonderful.
The ladies are doing some standard repertoire also from Bernstein, La Cage aux Folles numbers, Carol King numbers. They did mm-hmm. they did some Carol King numbers before. Just excellent work for ladies.
Is it hard to find good lyrically gay material, or is that as relevant as it once was? Or?
It's getting easier with the addition of GALA, the Gay and Lesbian Arts for Choral Arts Organization. They give us the opportunity to present ourselves as arrangers and composers and writers. The door is a little bit more, especially with the festivals mm-hmm. and the symposiums that are held.
And what is GALA?
Gay and Lesbian Organizations for Choral,
and it's choral international organization.
And it is an international mm-hmm. organization, and it's held every 4 years, and it's a week-long event that's held around the United States, and it's a big event.
It's a big deal. I've heard about it for many years, and it must be a terrific networking opportunity.
Yes, a wonderful opportunity to get our voice out, to get our word out,
to learn about new material,
to experience camaraderie. There's nothing mm-hmm. like bringing together thousands of gay and lesbian brothers and sisters.
Do
all
a little
unified.
Recruiting.
Yeah. Well, yeah, okay. Well, we can
and sing too.
Yes, but it's a great time. I had by all.
What's the biggest challenge of putting together an organization with a big umbrella?
Probably, as you know, being a non-profit organization, making sure that you have the funds in mm-hmm. order to work efficiently, you will always have the personal drive and motivation that comes naturally from members that want to be a part of the organization. But probably from the bottom line is bringing in underwriters and contributors and people that really want to work and stick in it for the long haul.
Has there been much turnover, like in the men's chorus? I know it's too early for the women's chorus to ask that question.
Well, no, not really. We have a pretty steady role, I would say. With a volunteer chorus, you're going to have that type of atmosphere. But we have, again, people with music and the community. We are a family, and we say that often in our rehearsals, and there's a love, and it takes a lot of dedication to come out on every Monday for 3 hours.
You don't want to do that.
Yes, and to prepare.
Yeah, we know. We come
concert.
Every 2 hours, every Monday.
And so it's a pretty tight schedule to do, but when something's done out of love, it makes it just a little bit easier.
How do people join the chorus? Do they audition?
No, it's not an audition chorus. We ask that you
be able to sing.
Well, no,
it'd help if you could sing. Yeah,
we ask that you do have a good spirit. That's the only thing. And then we also have many areas outside of the singing part of the chorus. Many volunteer areas behind the scenes. We have technical areas. We all know that it's a lot of the people behind the scenes that make us look good.
Oh.
So there's always a way for you to help out, whether it's singing or non-singing.
Hmm. What message do you want to get out to the community tonight on the air?
We want to get out to the community that we're about to kick off Pride in Houston, and Pride in Houston is a wonderful thing, and we're about to bring a wonderful chorus down to show the city and show everyone that there is power here, there is something going on, there is love, there is enlightenment, there is musical excellence being that's taking place here in the city among just being happy of being gay and lesbian.
And let's
transgendered.
And transgendered, yes.
Just didn't want to forget there.
Let's recap. The concert is when?
The concert is going to be on Saturday, June the 10th at 8 o'clock downtown at Jones Hall in Louisiana.
And who is it?
And it is going to be the Gay Men's Chorus of Houston and the Turtle Creek Chorale of Dallas, Texas. And there are going to be over 200 men on stage.
And singing. At the bars later.
And, well, we would hope that Houston would show their wonderful hospitality. I'm quite sure you will be able to see us. We will be the ones that will just probably be beaming with
pride.
You'll
still be beaming, yes.
And you'll be very well dressed.
Yes. But we really want to show Dallas our hospitality, reciprocate what happened when we went there on last mm-hmm. year, and just make it a part of a kickoff of Pride.
And the website again?
The website is www.BayouCityPerformingArts.org.
And the telephone number for tickets?
571-7464. And we have $15 tickets, so it is accessible. 15 to 34. Plenty of seats available.
Okay.
Thank you.
We want to thank Ken Claiborne from the Bayou City Chorus for meeting with us tonight, and you're listening to Queer Voices.
Thank you.
Yeah.
going to bring you a special encore interview with KJ Dennert that I did from last year, and we're going to really get into her music, which is good because she's one of our main Pride Festival artists.
Queer Music Heritage
on KPFT in Houston.
This is J.D. Doyle with a Queer Music Heritage New Music Spotlight. My regular show, Queer Music Heritage, is heard monthly on Queer Voices on the fourth Monday of the month. But as that segment is more oriented towards the older music of our culture, I often do not get to feature as many new artists as I'd like. And there are plenty of very talented artists whose work deserves to be shared with our listeners. So this feature is designed to do just that. You get to hear some of the music from the artist's latest CD, along with some interview comments. And the spotlight this time is on a New York artist named KJ Dennert. KJ has been performing in bands for over 25 years, but it's only been the last few years that she's been concentrating on her solo career, and the album I'm featuring is her third release on her own. I became aware of her while I was a judge for the Out Music Awards. The judging is done online, and I started listening to her and immediately stopped my judging and wrote her about her CD. I wasn't wrong, and she went on to be nominated for an award for Outstanding New Recording Female. When I went to New York City for the awards, I arranged for an interview with her, and she's a delight in person as much as her music is a delight to hear. Before we get to the interview, I want to share a song from her new album. The album is called Girl Like Me, and see how long it takes you to recognize the song.
Well, I come from Alabama.
Of course, that was Oh Susanna, done as you've never heard it done before. KJ has an ability to do a cover version of a song and make it her own, even for old chestnuts like that song. We'll hear another example later, but I want to stress that she is not a cover artist. Her own songwriting is as wonderful as her silky smooth vocals and expert guitar work. I first asked her to describe her musical style.
Well, I call the music that I write and perform urban folk and jazz. I decided a long time ago, since I pulled from a lot of different places, not specifically R&B, not solely folk music, that I needed to give the style of music that I was doing a name. And urban folk means folk music that comes maybe not from the country, or maybe not from like the Appalachian tradition. This is folk music as taken from someone who grew up in New York City in the 60s and the 70s. And the jazz part really is about the improvisation that the band and I do with my music.
What would be your description of your voice?
Wow, my description of my voice. I think it's starting to sound somewhat seasoned. I guess you could call it a smooth-sounding voice, you know, and for that part, there's not a lot I can take credit for. You sort of wind up with the voice that you have and then, you know, learn to do, you know, what it does best. I get compared to people, like, I think, like, quality-wise, sometimes people say my voice sounds like Roberta Flack's voice. But I'll sing music that might sound more like it came from James Taylor or Sting or something like that. Wow, how do I describe my voice? Hopefully likable. I'm not a screamer. I'm not a wailer. I just really love melody.
I was thinking if you took Roberta Flack and James Taylor and Bonnie Raitt and put them in a pile and melted honey over them.
Ah. Yeah, I would agree with that. Usually I say, if Sting, Roberta, and Roberta Flack were married and then he had an affair with Ricky Lee Jones, I would have written the musical for that tryst. So, you're right in there.
Tell us about the new album.
The new album, Girl Like Me, is one that I'm very happy that it's finished, first of all. And it's doing a really nice job. For me, when I say it does a nice job, my CD has to get out and meet people in other parts of the world, in other parts of the country that I can't personally meet, and the response has been so wonderful. The record is like me. It's a collection of tunes that I've been doing, some of them for a long time, and it features not just, you know, hired hands or studio musicians. It features people that I've been playing with, you know, since 1997, actually. So it's a real culmination of, I call it, up to this point, there's my life's work. You're going to hear some Brazilian influences on the title track, Girl Like Me. You're going to hear some serious tunes, like a tune called How Many Ways. I think it captures a lot of elements of who I am, and I was very aware when I was making this record that this was the one that I was going to sort of send out a flare, say, hello world, here I am. And I wanted to put a little bit of everything that I enjoy, even down to a cover of Oh Susanna, which is a favorite of many audiences and a little unusual, and then some covers of the Beatles and Sting, which are also somewhat unusual. So infused with that urban folk and jazz style, or that KJ style.
Tell us about the song Little Mary.
Little Mary. I wrote that song quite some time ago, and I finished refining it by the time it came out on this record. Little Mary was absolutely a song written to make me feel better, written during the time where I was working a full-time job, coming home late at night, doing gigs, doing everything I could to keep my music alive. And, you know, there was a point in my life after being on the road where I had to go back and take a day job. And many people see that almost as a kind of failing. It's like, well, I didn't make it. And I didn't look at it in any way like that. I looked at, by having a day job, I could therefore put out as many records as I have. And Little Mary is like a fun lullaby to myself, you know, saying, just don't be afraid. You know, everybody is scared when they're going after what's in their heart.
Feeling this way, yeah, yeah. summer's day.
Tell me about the song Violet. That's so such a sexy song.
Oh, Violet. Well, there's two key things about Violet. One of them is that I think that James Taylor, I often refer to him as being my first guitar teacher. And so the song Violet is absolutely a tip of the hat to the kind of guitar style that I loved from James Taylor when he was making records like Mudslide Slim and One Man Dog. And there's just a way that the acoustic guitars sounded, and I really spent some time trying to put those kinds of licks in there, and I thought that the melody and the arrangement were very James Taylor-ish. And I was always saying it's a tip of the hat to James Taylor. The story of Violet, another song to sort of keep myself going, the story of Violet is me at the shoreline, where I am so often, you know, asking, will I find new music to write? You know, I'm sort of coming out of a darker place feeling better, and the lyric says, oh Violet, do you have a song for me? Which is, you know, it's me talking to the violet sky and also talking to, another woman in my life, you know. Oh Violet, is there another song for me? So it's a sort of a broad watercolor of what I feel like when I'm trying to keep moving forward, and always trying to take note that I'm feeling a little better, so you know, things got to be going okay.
She's waiting and she's fighting things beyond her reach. She's walking in the wind upon a beach. She says, wash away these footprints, take them out to sea, gather up my fondest and my hard-earned memories. Oh, Violet, do you have a song for me? I've been feeling so much better, can't you see? Be by your side, steady like the tide, just waiting for your company.
How about the song Girl Like Me?
Girl Like Me is what I consider my faux Brazilian feel. When I was a kid, I used to set up my G.I. Joes, and I used to have them behave as though they were a band. I set them all up with instruments, and then I would put on Sergio Mendes, and I would just dance the hours away. That was how my childhood was spent. And I often tell that story before I launch into Girl Like Me. Girl Like Me is a groove tune that came to me pretty much in one fell swoop. And that's a fun tune, and sort of says, I guess, you know, that's a more confident tune, I guess. That's one of my more confident tunes. So don't mess with a girl like me, because, you know, I'm ready.
I've been listening for hours. I've been staying up way past ten. I have cast away the flowers.
How did that end up as the title track?
Well, it seemed to make sense because I think that the CD is eclectic. I don't think it sounds like, you know, seven different artists, but I pull from a lot of different styles, and that's not something that necessarily goes on commercial records these days. But being an independent, I have the freedom to put out the music as I hear it and as I like it. And so when you look at it as a collection, this is a collection of stories about a girl like me who plays guitar and likes to sing, and but also, you know, for the musicians, there's a kind of writing that I like. There's a kind of harmony, there's a kind of balance in my songwriting, you know, if you want to take it to another level. So you'll hear a Brazilian type song, and you'll hear maybe a more R&B influence, but the things that make music interesting for me run through all of them without, you know, having a single style that's going to cut through. So yeah, Girl Like Me made sense. Here was a song called Girl Like Me, and here was a whole CD of conversations ultimately with myself saying, you'll be okay, you're feeling better. Like, I have to be my own cheering section.
Of what song on the album are you the most proud?
You know, as a songwriter, the song How Many Ways is one that I'm most proud of as a song, as a composition. You know, the melding of a melody, lyrics, and message. You know, one that in my songs I try very hard not to preach, but to share, you know, this is what it feels like, this is what it looks like around me. And the song How Many Ways is a song that says, you know, this is a song about grief and getting past it. And you know, if the last 5 years have been anything in the world, never mind just my small existence, it's been about grief and getting past it and using it hopefully for the better.
I will feel better.
Songs are biographical?
They are biographical, but I don't think you're necessarily going to catch the story of me so much as I see my songs as almost watercolors. And it's funny, there were a lot of times colors. I didn't, you know, not intentional, violets or red July. I think of it as almost like watercolors of this is what it feels like. So I try to, yeah, just try to paint some pictures that aren't necessarily specific, general enough that you just sort of get a little picture of what's going on.
Is there an overall message you hope your music gets across?
Yeah, I suppose. I don't really want to preach to anyone. The things that I, you know, my personal belief is that the truth is something that is very powerful. And I don't think in our culture we know well enough how to use the truth. So I want my songs to be very honest, and also want to take a slightly more realistic view of love, romantic love, disappointment, grief, things that are part of, you know, modern life. Like, this is what it feels like to look at somebody else's grief and still move on. This is what it feels like to go to the beach and hope that, you know, you can wash away some of the sad memories and look at how much better it's going to be. Songs of hope, you know, hope based on being who you really are.
I've got one more song to ask about, but before we get into it, I want to let you know where you can find out more about this artist. Her name again is K.J. Dennhert, and Dennhert is spelled D-E-N-H-E-R-T. And her website is at www.kjdennhert.com, where you can hear sound clips and find out more about all of her music. Okay, on to the last song of this segment. How did you pick the song She Loves You to cover?
I started covering that back in 1993, I think, and I never put it on a record. And there was a club owner, and when I got to the end of the record, I said to a couple people, you know, what other songs should I put on there? So the way that it made it to the record was that the audience said, absolutely. The last two songs that were recorded and put on the record were She Loves You and Oh Susanna, and the audience was like, you have got to put those tunes down, because even though they're somebody else's, you know, nobody does them like you. And how I came to actually arrange the tune, Melissa Etheridge was very popular at the time, and I had noticed that people really enjoy when women strum guitars, you know, just really hard and put lots of strumming in there. And I was playing around with this one particular chord, and I sort of heard the arrangement coming out of this guitar strum. It was almost like a Melissa Etheridge feel, and then I just, you know, sort of heard it like a reharmonization or a reinterpretation of the song. And then once I set up that feel, I just followed that feel and played the right chords, or else played nice substitutions. And that one does seem to get people's attention.
Think you lost your love? Well, I saw her yesterday. It's you she's thinking of, and she told me what to say. She said she loves you. Oh,
Again, that was K.J. Denner, and that was a fun interview to do, kind of a behind-the-scenes look at really what makes an artist tick. And that, for me, that makes me appreciate the music all that much more.
That's an incredibly beautiful voice.
Oh, and I always like to ask, you know, what song they're most proud of, and why did you do this song, and, you know, how did that come to you? And thus, that kind of stuff really fleshes out, you know, what's going on in the music.
That's always so interesting when you do that, because it gives you an insight into the artist. And, you know, you may have heard a song and you enjoy it, but you now you know why they wrote the song the way they did and performed it the way they did.
I'm going to do a lot more of that kind of stuff in the next couple of weeks. I'll be going to New York for my annual trip to the Out Music Awards. I always look forward to that. I've been heavily involved in that organization for a number of years. I've been a judge every year. The judging is done already. We don't know the results, but the judging's all done, and we do it online now, which is kind of cool.
That's great. It's when is this now?
Awards itself is June 11th, a Sunday in New York, but there's a number of events leading up to it, the concerts, house concerts, video parties. It'll be a full week. I've already got like half my week already planned.
Are you going to be back on that Monday after that?
Nope.
You won't? Nope. Are you going to phone in an interview and tell us all about it?
Actually, as soon as I get home, I'll be starting to work on our coverage for This Way Out, because This Way Out gives us about half of a show to cover the awards, and we'll be featuring quotes from the winners and so forth, and that's a lot of script to write in a short amount of time. So I'll be working on that, so we'll hear it on the This Way Out. And in July, I'll do my own kind of salute to the Out Music Awards on Queer Music Heritage, a more lighter coverage, playing the winners and some songs I think should have won.
Well, that's always good. You know, you have your own opinion of what should have won. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've ever watched any award show or heard something. There's always the one that it should have been.
Yes, well, I have the luxury on my show. I allow two or three songs, room for two or three songs that, okay, this one is very worthwhile. You should know about this one, too.
Well, we want to remind you again of Turtles on the Bayou. That's the gay men's chorus. And this year, the Turtle... Now, Dallas...
Turtle Creek Chorale.
Chorale will also be on the performance, or in the performance, and they'll do separate performances and then do some performances together. And that is Saturday, June 10th at 8 p.m. And as part of Pride...
Yeah, we want to thank Kenneth Claiborne for coming on to talk about that with us.
Also, remind you that the Women's Chorus is singing on Saturday, June 17th at 8 p.m., taking center stage. Now, these are all going to be at Bering Methodist Church.
Oh. And more info at www... Oh, it's a long address.
Yes.
Help me out with that.
Oh, it's here it is.
Bayou City Performing Arts... .com. So check them out there.
Yeah. And after the Turtles on the Bayou performance, you can come out to the Transgender Unity Committee this year.
Does it say that on that piece of paper?
No, it doesn't say that.
Okay.
I'm just sort of putting that one in. For the first time for Pride, the Transgender Unity Committee is going to have its fall dance in June.
Well, you always kind of went your own way, anyhow.
Well, it was a little different. We wanted to be part of Pride.
Well, at least
so
it doesn't work, you can do it again.
Yes, well, it's going to be at Meteor. It starts at 9 to 2, and return to the Bayou to the Palm Beach Club is the theme. And some people don't remember that club, but it was a fun place to hang out for many, many years, but they tore down the hotel.
What's up next week on...
Well, I'm going to be interviewing Ellen Cohen. And she is candidate for House District 134, and she's running against Martha Wong.
Oh, good.
Did I say that right? I always want to say wrong instead of Wong, but, you know. Let's see there. Who else?
David Elias, I'm sure, will be in with his D.C. report.
Yes. Is Jones supposed to have one next week?
You know, I think so. I think Joan has one, maybe two spots next week.
Joan is working on a couple of things, yeah.
I know she's got one on the 12th. I saw that on an email. But I'm not sure about next week. But anyway.
Okay. Please stay tuned for Queer Music Heritage, the second hour of our show tonight, where I get to share with you all a interview I love doing with one of our women's music icons, Farron.
We get more of you?
Yeah, more of me.
Good night.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Valensky, Joan Devlin, J.D. Doyle, and Glenn Holt.
Hey! Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy. This way.
This is Queer Voices on KPFT, and this segment is called Queer Music Heritage. I'm J.D. Doyle, and this is one of those rare editions of QMH where I'm devoting the entire show to one artist, and there's no question that she merits this attention. She's iconic in the genre of women's music, and her name is Farron. So stay with me to hear an exclusive interview with her, and we'll talk about her music in general and quite a number of her songs in particular. But for perhaps my younger listeners, let me give a quick introduction to Farron. She was born in Toronto and was raised in a small working-class community on the west coast of Canada, near Vancouver. She started writing songs as a teenager and into her 20s had to take a variety of jobs to make ends meet. At age 25 in 1977, she released her first album, called Farron, on her own label and printed up just 1,000 copies. It was a two-track acoustic project, and a year later, she repeated this effort with 1,000 copies of her second release, called Farron Backed Up, getting that name since it included some backup musicians. These two releases attracted enough attention that by 1980, she was able to borrow enough to record her first studio album. That album, called Testimony, paved the way for her real start, with critical acclaim and national touring. Let's skip ahead a bit. You've heard me talk about Hot Wire magazine before, and I interviewed its editor on my show last September. It was a magazine about women's music, and one I very much respected. In 1992, it featured a reader's poll, and Farron was voted all-time favorite performer. And in 1993, 13 years after its release, Testimony was voted all-time favorite album. Other outstanding albums by her have included Shadows on a Dime, Phantom Center, Still Riot, and Driver. Her lyrics are personal, poetic, and powerful, and the Boston Globe paid her high praise by saying, "Someday they will call Dylan the Farron of the 60s. I interviewed Farron just a few months after the release of her first album in 9 years, and she tells us about the new album and touches on the journey during these recent years.
The new CD is called Turning Into Beautiful, and what I love about that CD is that it took about another 9 years since the last CD to record, and it's just like a soup. It's just more seasoned, more reflective on what it's like getting older with all its losses and its gains.
Your new album, Turning Into Beautiful, opens with the song More Than That, in which you sing, "Hello, my friends, I feel so happy to be back, to feel so clear and on the track." It's a beautiful welcoming to your album. Can you elaborate on that sentiment?
So many Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot of that kind of attitude through the whole CD, which is, what do I mean when I say it's more than that? Well, anybody in the know knows what I mean. You know, it's like sometimes it takes a long time to, A, realize that where you are is okay and that's where you are, or else it takes you a long time to get back to where you were. And am I happy to be back? Am I happy? But it's everything. It's like all the losses and all the anxieties or the questions about self or anything all the way along are there before I get back to that moment of saying, yeah, okay, I'm happy to be back at work. I'm happy to be back as an artist. I'm happy to be back on Earth, or, you know, to be back willing to, you know, live my life. It's all that.
Have you found that when you think back on your early works, that you perhaps learned something from what you wrote years and years ago?
Yes. I mean, and I must be a slow learner, because, I mean, I've had to sing, I mean, willingly, but fascinatingly, has sung many of the same songs, and as I write another CD, I add some more songs, but people still want to hear right from the very first CD. So even as I was growing older, because now it's like I started in 75 performing, to go back and sing a song that I wrote, you know, in 1975, and find that I don't have a problem with it. I mean, it was one of the criterion for me to say, is this a good song? Could I sing it forever? And, I mean, you know, I can. I can, because somewhere the place that I'm writing from, it doesn't change. I think a cave person, you know, if they could have sung, would have sung the same song.
Has your relationship to some of those early songs changed?
Some of them I've grown more reverent toward, more respectful. It's like, how did I know that then? And how come I've forgotten it so many times since? It's almost like when you know, when they say, you know, watch a 4 and 5 year old, you know, where they're living is pre-controlled mind, you know, and so what they're telling you is really their truth. And I feel that way about some of my early songs. Like, I knew something from an antenna or a real instinctive place that, you know, years later I had to go back and learn again. Because I didn't know I'd lost it, but once I knew it, I had to go back and get it, and you can't get it the same way.
On your new album, I love the country sound on some of the songs with the steel guitar. Did you have those arrangements in mind when you finished writing them?
Yeah. I had gone to my producer, and basically, I mean, one of the things was, you know, you only have so much money when you're making your own CDs. And basically what I said is, you know, we're a bed plus one is what I felt I could afford, which required all my players to be as talented as they could be in the bed track sessions. And then we were going to add one more tone. And I decided, and Johnny and I decided, that the pedal steel was the tone, because it has so much longing and so much heart. And so that was the instrument that is running throughout.
I've listened to it several times in a row, and my reaction is that the CD is very comforting.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. That's exactly what I want to hear. I mean, you know, I think when you're young, you can write, and you're supposed to write the upset and the anger and the this and the that, and it can be full of questions, and everybody's thrilled that the questions are there. But I find it kind of awkward for me as I get older to continue on that vein, because I don't really feel it. I feel like, you know, I've seen the ball bounce quite a few times. I know how high it bounces. I can't ask the question, how high bounces the ball? That's not my job now. I don't think that's my job. That's somebody else's job. You know, I want to talk about something else.
My favorite song of yours is Ain't Life a Brook. Can you tell us about that song?
Well, you know, the song Ain't Like a Brook actually was more mature than I am, or than I was when I wrote it. And sometimes I write where I'm at, and sometimes I write where I'm going. And Ain't Like a Brook is like that. It had an understanding of, for a minute when I was in that song, I had an understanding of the bittersweet trade exchange between freedom and love and possession and love. I saw what had to happen in my growth, in order for me to grow. And I actually think that that song is nurtured by this one belief that I have, which is that people are instinctively intelligent and emotionally alert and desiring to be kind.
I watch you reading a book. I get to thinking our love's a polished stone. You give me a long, drawn look. I know pretty soon you're gonna leave our home. And of course I might. Especially when I'm thinking from my heart. But life don't clickety-clack down a straight line track. It come together and it come apart. You say you hope I'm not the kind to make you feel obliged to go digging through your time with a pain look in your eyes. You give me the furniture, we'll divide the photographs. Go out to dinner one more time, have ourselves a bottle of wine and a couple of laughs. And when first you left, I stayed so sad I wouldn't sleep. I know that love's a gift. I thought yours was mine. It's something that I could keep. Now I realize time is not the only compromise. A bird in the hand could be an all-night stand between a blazing fire and a pocket of skies. And so I hope I'm not the kind to make you feel obliged. Taken through your time with a pain look in your eyes. I covered the furniture, I framed the photographs. Went out to dinner one more time, had myself a bottle of wine and a couple of laughs. And just the other day I got your letter in the mail. I'm happy for you, it's been so long. You've been wanting a cabin and a backwoods trail. And I think that's great. Me, I seem to find myself in school. It's all okay, I just wanna say I swear to you, we didn't do it cruel. But ain't life a brook? Just when I get to feeling like a polished stone, I get me a long drawn look. It's kind of a drag to find yourself alone, and sometimes I'm mine. Especially when I'm waiting on your heart. But life don't clickety-clack down a straight line track. It come together and it come apart. Cause I know you're not the kind to make me feel obliged to go taking through my time with a pain look in my. I sold the furniture, I put away the photographs. Went out to dinner one more time, skipped a bottle of wine, had a couple of laughs. Wasn't that fun?
And that was her classic song, Ain't Life a Brook. Why do you think that song is so very popular with your fans?
You know, I had a friend tell me that you couldn't really know love until you had loved someone and left them. And they, or, you know, first of all, that they had loved you and left, but then when you had loved and left. And at that point, you're in the realm of love, because it has to have forgiveness on both parts. And I remember at the time not really knowing what the hell she was talking about. completely. But as time went on, and when I look at the song Ain't Life a Brook, that's what that song's talking about. It's like, you know, to try to find a way, and I've tried to do it for years, to try to find a way to write where there are no villains. It's a wonderful place to be.
It's not she left me, it's what happened, not something inflicted.
Yeah, I suppose it's, you know, in another more general way would be to say if you have lemons, you make lemonade. I mean, it's like, what is there in, you know, in the moment and in the pain that, I mean, it's a map, too. I've heard that from people. It was, Ain't Life a Brook ended up being a map for the way out of the grieving, or a way through the grieving. And, you know, I have grieved. I have loved and I have lost, and I know the terrain.
In the introduction to this show, I talked about your breakthrough album, Testimony, from 1980. Could you tell us about the title track for that album?
Testimony, the song, was written in Toronto, and what had happened was, in a nutshell, I had been asked to write a song for a film called This Film Is About Rape. And I had been gang raped when I was younger. And I went back to the police and tried to get some information. I didn't exactly know how to write this song. And in the process, you know, you could barely find the information or whatever, and was young enough to not realize the effect that this was going to have on me. Consequently, you know, in the ensuing months, I really went on a tear. I mean, I just wanted to run away from me so bad that I ended up in Toronto when I lived in Vancouver. And while I was there, I just was living, really. I knew I had to have this song by September 14th, and now it's, you know, the day before, and I still don't have the song, and it was the thing that I was running from, the thing that I was running toward. And that night, I ended up, I think it's almost like a trance. I mean, I ended up taking a walk with this very weird kind of man. I'm sure he was real, but sometimes I wonder. On a bicycle, had a conversation with me, and then I went back home and I wrote that song, and got up in the morning and took another look at it and thought, well, I guess that's the song, because this is the day. And I called them and said, I have it, you know, and so they used it, and I ended up calling it Testimony because it was like a testimonial.
There's godlike and warlike and strong like only some show. And there's sad like and mad like and had like we know. But by my light, the eyes be red. And by there are waters hidden from us. In the maze we find them still. We'll take you to them. You take your young ones. May they take their own and turn and buy. Our lives be we spirit. And by our hearts be we. By our hands, be we whole.
Very nice. That was a little of the title track from Testimony. And I gave you an extra treat there. I went from Farron singing the first verse of her song to the last verse as sung by Sweet Honey and the Rock from 1983. They adored Farron's song and made it a staple of their concerts around the world. And I need to mention that in order to cover as many songs as possible on this show, I can only feature clips of the songs, and I'm going to try and cover her music in roughly chronological order. Also from the Testimony album, I've found that when I hear the song Misty Mountain, the song stays with me. I find that the next day I notice the chorus going through my head.
Misty Mountain, I was living in a friend's basement. I had a small room, and there was a couple of years in there where I was really impoverished spiritually. I didn't know what to do, and I was so full of questions and everything. And at one point, said, you know, what do you need? You know, I couldn't get out of bed at one period for about 3 weeks, and I was living with friends, and he said, what do you need? And I said, no, I need a room, you know, a dark room where I can rest and something with cedar in it so that I can play the guitar, and I like to play the guitar in the dark. So they put a bathroom down there, and it was made out of cedar, and I went in there and closed the door and just started. I felt alone, so I felt like I could really sing loud, and I just belted out those lyrics. So then I went running to the, you know, typewriter and typed them up.
Up the misty mountain, wildflowers bind the ground. Down by the rushing river, forests will wear those boulders down. Me, I'm underneath my covers. Me, I'm trapped inside my brain. Well, up above the misty mountain, up above the rushing river.
In 1984, you released Shadows on a Dime. Please tell me about the title track.
Shadows on a Dime, I was on a train. I had flown from Santa Cruz, where I had done 2 sold-out shows, and then I was going to New York for the first time. And I was on a train, fell into a sleep, and I had already had the music. You know, sometimes you pick up the guitar on your plane and you're going over the same licks over and over. And I had this music. When I woke up, the dream that I'd been dreaming, I knew fit right on that guitar pattern. And so I put them together, and it was true. I hardly had to alter anything. They just, the words and the guitar found each other. And it became the title track for the next CD, because the next CD was Shadows on a Dime, I think, was the CD itself, was about the price of your emotional life and your physical life and your professional life, and understanding, you know, that life was a lesson and what everything cost. So Shadows on a Dime, I mean, it was written in a dream, and it just had that feeling of the desperation of the soul that wants something, and the earth and the businesses want us to do something else with our soul. And so that's what that whole CD is about.
This window makes a perfect frame for New England leaves like painted rain. They hold me as I hold this train, all shadows on a dime. You move forward fast by holding back. You gauge your steps and you don't look slack. Me, I'm looking backward down the track to see us dreamers in our prime. I poured my soul in Santa Cruz. I ached all night, next day I lost my shoes. It's so optional what you may or may not lose in this pattern we call time.
From Phantom Center from 1990 is the song My My, and it contains the line, "I remember that time I told you about your love in the polished stone." That seems to be a direct reference to a line from Ain't Life a Brook.
That time I told you about your love and the polished stone. It's so easy to forgive you now that I'm polishing up my home. I got to kiss the face of heaven, and then when she kissed me back, I tried to roll my lucky sevens, and now I'm back on the inside track.
Yeah, and I think that was probably the first time that it occurred to me that I was only telling one story. That I, me as an artist, or what they say, an artist simply only has one story. So it didn't seem preposterous to me to go back, acknowledge that I had an intimacy with an audience, and also make reference to something from the past.
Also from Phantom Center, please tell me about the song Harmless Love.
Harmless Love, I had won a green card, and I was now going to go live in the United States. And I had written, some 10-page poem, something like akin to Paradise Lost, trying to find out my feelings about going to live in a country that was also, you know, doing things in Nicaragua and Argentina. And, you know, I'm a Canadian, I'm not an American, and I had a great turmoil over that move. And I mean, how I ended up resolving it was by saying that I was going to go and share my turmoil with more people if I sang in the United States. And the night before I was leaving, I was walking down the street in Vancouver, and it was raining, and I started whistling this little melody, and I don't know why, it was just, that was the question, what's the matter with Harmless? And then I bumped into a friend, and we had a talk for a minute, and I went home. And that night I stayed up and wrote that whole song. And I think that Harmless Love and Phantom Center on the same CD was the dilemma of Phantom Center, was the whole question of it. It's like, on one hand, there's this vulgar greed and violence and disrespect for other people that exists all the time, and also, why can't we just be harmless? What, you know, why isn't that an aspiration? So that's how that song came out.
What's the matter with harmless? Take a new step in an old direction. If you think about tenderness, what's the matter with harmless love? I take a little walk outside in a town that brings me pears and peaches. I'm busting with love inside, and it's always more than it ever teaches. On the curb I pass a friend of mine. We seem a little older, maybe a little wiser. We laugh about the shades of time and marvel at love, the great sky rider. What's the matter with harmless? Take a new step in an old direction. If you think about tenderness, what's the matter with a hand on a hand affection? Do you dream?
From your album Driver from 1994, there's a line in your song Girl on the Road that says, "I wanted to turn beautiful and serve eternity." And the title of your new album is Turning Into Beautiful. Is there a connection to those messages?
You know what? It was totally unconscious. But later, what happened was, after I had written Turning Into Beautiful, and then I was back on stage doing a show, I'm singing Girl on the Road, and I got to that line, and I about stopped singing. I just was, inside of my head was like, huh. Wow.
Good. I didn't want to think I was imagining it.
Yeah. Boy, you've noticed it all. I mean, I actually hadn't thought about it at the time, but I did later when I, like I said, when I was right in the middle of singing it. Oh, my God.
Can you tell me about the song itself?
Girl on the Road, I was in Chicago at the Folk Music, School of Folk Music, and we were touring the Canadian Festival Tour. I was the headliner, and a bunch of Canadians, we were doing this thing through the States, which was kind of laughable. I mean, it didn't go over very well. And the sound checks were forever because there was like five acts or something, and I was always last. I went into this back room, and there was an old school desk, the kind with the inkwell. And when I was young, at home, in my family life, I would hide down in the basement, and there was an old school desk, and I'd write. And so I went and put myself in that desk, and you know, it's like as if the desk was holding the song. And when I sat down, it just ended up just being the story of my life. And I think then that was in 1989 or 90 or something like that. And I wasn't sure about continuing doing music. That was a hard tour. And I think that song was myself telling me that there really was no other rock to carry, or there was nothing else to do. This was the thing to do, and it was, and that writing and singing had been the thing that had freed me from all the other things that were in the other verses. The darkness in my family life, the idea of love affairs that didn't work out, the sense of freedom that I thought I had and couldn't find, and you know, all of it's in there, and a forgiveness and a compassion that I ultimately only got from doing music and letting the song teach me. And so that's what Girl on the Road is about.
I don't know what it's like for you, but here's what it's like for me. I wanted to turn beautiful and serve eternity and never follow money or love with greasy hands or move the earth and waters just to make it fit my plans. My eyes would be the harbor, my words the perfect plea for a girl.
Another very popular album for you came out in 1996 and was called Still Riot. Would you please tell me about the song Still Riot and what it means?
It was the beginning of my elder perspective, in the sense that all of us got older. We ended up with kids or mortgages or decisions that we thought we'd never make, and we did because we had to. And you just couldn't know when you were 20 that how life would put you in such a jam. At the same time, there's a certain grace and a meditation to life. And what I wanted to say, and I hoped I said, was that to change the world, sometimes it's to stay still. And sometimes, even when you're meditating, you're changing the world with a fury. And so that it was two things. Still Riot, meaning please continue, and also that the change as we get older happens on the inside.
Every person has their story, the one they vamp and revamp. There is a way through constant sorrow,
But we must do more than light the lamp. I light Cheval at the window. Pine and Laura's love. We dare not wait, but we'll join the high suspended dove. But yesterday, my baby girl woke up to a little boy. I watched her curl her arms around him and transform her fear to joy. If I believe we've blown our purpose, then I might have missed the chance. You see Gandhi and Bibi Buddy, I watch them spin and dance. You gotta go for fire, you gotta go for what you know so well. You gotta go for why you came this way and live your story tall.
I want to chime in at this point that I've compiled a number of articles on Farron, and I'm one of those music fans who just has to see the label artwork and read the liner notes. You'll be able to do that at my website, and if you visit it while you're listening, you can see the playlist and follow along. I've always considered our music history as a visual as well as an audio experience. Again, that's at www.queermusicheritage.com. Also, for more very queer programming, please listen to After Hours with Jimmy Carper every Saturday night, Sunday morning from 1 to 4 a.m. on KPFT. It's queer radio with attitude. Have your feelings changed about your songwriting over the years?
I respect it more. I see now, you know, when I put it all out, like if I had to, you know, when I have to type up something for, like I have to type up Still Riot for the web page, or, you know, had everything together for a minute because I thought I would do an anthology of all the songs, a book of all the lyrics, and I started looking at it, and, you know, it is a whole and searching spiritual life that I put on paper.
You've been an out musician for many years. Has your image of that changed over the years? Is it more important now, less important?
It's always important. I mean, a kind of an honest presentation, the ability to live with yourself is always important. I don't think it becomes any less. It certainly had more of a price tag on it when I decided that I wouldn't be in the closet. But it just depended on what you thought you were paying. I mean, I grew up surrounded by, you know, deception and secrets, and I just couldn't stand it, and I couldn't perpetrate it in my own life. I would rather have died, actually. And so, you know, there was more at stake for me to lie about myself than there was to tell the truth, because I wouldn't be able to live.
On the lighter side, how did you get the name Farron?
My name Farron was given to me by a couple of friends who, I don't know, somebody had a dream. And at a certain point in my life, I was called Rusty. I mean, no one even knew what to call me. And so they said, oh, this is your name is Farron. And I'm like, well, what's that? I don't know, but that's what it is. And in the dream, there was three of us, and that was my name. And so that would be back in the very early 70s. And first time I went somewhere to try to sing, the guy's like very gruff, and he's like, what's your name, you know? So I said, Farron.
In the year 2000, Farron released a double CD retrospective album called Impressionistic, and it includes 28 songs covering all of her career. In an ad for your CD Impressionistic, Lady Slipper Music said, neither she nor we would suggest that anyone ought to listen to a double Farron CD all at one sitting. Do you agree with that comment?
Actually, that's what I said. Because, you know, of course, I had to listen to it to get it ready. And it was just like, oh my God, you know, all the different images and feelings. And then there's some kind of cohesion because it was the same voice through
through the whole thing. That it just made it almost too much. I actually thought that was going to be my last CD. You know, after the Warner Brothers thing, then the band, we just kind of split up. And actually, other than Shelley, my guitar player, I never saw anybody anymore. My producer and I ended up in a conversation, and I just thought spiritually and emotionally it was just the same sort of bland place that, you know, it's time to take a stab at this again.
In 1999, Theron recorded a unique album for her at June Millington's Institute for the Musical Arts, or IMA. The album is called Inside Out. It's an album of cover songs, and I love that album for some of the same reasons you'll hear her talk about.
Inside Out actually was about the songs that I had grown up with, that, you know, listening on my transistor as I walked in, you know, junior high, and being completely fascinated with the music. And not, I mean, I still really don't know music theory. I couldn't tell you anything about music. And we went back and just reclaimed those songs. For me, it was a thrill to see how simple some of them were musically, and some of them were very complicated.
How did you pick the songs for that album?
I picked the songs because they were the songs that I loved growing up. Down Without Pity, I heard from a movie, and I was completely mesmerized by that. I would have been kind of young, but as time went on, you know, I pulled it back. All of those songs were just songs that, I mean, I think the only thing I would have added to it was Society's Child, you know, because that was the other song that really mattered.
Which track is your favorite from it?
What Becomes of the Broken Hearted, the Ruffin song. And man, was it hard to sing. I mean, he must have huge lungs. And for me, I mean, I ended up feeling bruised by the time, because if you really ever notice the line, there's nowhere to breathe.
Right, it just carries the thought and carries it and carries it.
And, you know, man, I wanted to own that song, and I really had to practice.
As I walk this land of broken dreams, I have visions of many things, but happiness is just an illusion, filled with sadness and confusion. What becomes of the broken hearted who have loves that have now departed? I know I've got to find some kind of peace of mind, maybe. The roots of love.
Down Without Pity, I think it's a fascinating song, and it also was a real, you mean, you had to sing it. And Walk Away, Renee, you know, these are, I'm telling you, my favorites on that, in terms of me being completely connected and getting it from the inside out. Walk Away, Renee was a tearjerker. And Don't Worry, Baby, you know, really fascinated me.
There's like a who's who of women's music helping you in that recording. An all-star cast, June and Jean Millington, Adrian Torf, Mary Watkins, Teresa Trall, Barbara Higbee, Rhiannon, Gwen Avery, Chris Williamson, Trent Fury.
Yeah, that was when we lived at IMA, when I lived at IMA, and we had a studio, recording studio off the kitchen.
What are the hardest lessons you have learned from your over 30 years of writing and performing music?
Well, quite often you're only as good as your last song. And you have to keep some sense of yourself together. It's hard to learn that about how fickle a media culture is. You know, I've had some absolutely loyal followers all of my life, and when we brought out Turning Into Beautiful and put it, you know, on the web, and I had a web page and everything, there was a way then for people to communicate with me, and I just couldn't believe some of the letters that I got. But at the same time, every time there's a decade, and I don't mean it by the years, but by the birth of people, you have to figure out how you're going to jump the decade into the next generation of person. And if you're not in the system, it's really tricky. It's really tricky.
So that was a hard thing to learn. By the same token, it was hard for me to accept my worth to other people. Because sometimes left alone, it's a really small, dark room, and I don't have a way out. And yet there's a whole bunch of people, thousands of people, who hold me in this incredible esteem. And I am not able to match it. Like, that's been the hardest thing for me to learn.
The pressures of being almost a cult figure?
And maybe that's what, I don't know what it's called. It's about learning, it's about realizing at a certain point in your life that other people possibly loved you more than you did. That's a sad lesson. And also kind of curious, so, you know.
Maybe appreciate is a better word.
Yeah, I mean, it's a more distant word, but I mean, if you saw some of the letters, appreciate is not strong enough. I mean, there are people who, I think, used some of the songs to actually make it from point A to point B without offing themselves. You know, and in some ways, so did I. You know, I mean, I had to make meaning out of a meaningless life.
I started the show with Farron's latest album, Turning Into Beautiful, released late last year. It's her first album of original material in 9 years. Did some of your fans express an impatience because it was 9 years since your last album of original material? Like, Where Have You Been? I Needed You?
Not impatience, but definitely that they were really sort of happy that my voice was back. And I never got the sense of impatience. I mean, it's like when I think about me waiting for Ricky Lee to come back, you know, after she'd had her fame and everybody knew that she was somewhere hurting herself. You just pray before magazine came out or something, you know, that I felt sad that I would have to live out the rest of my life without hearing her voice. And then she came back, you know. And it was true, she was really gone, you know. She was hurting herself.
From Turning Into Beautiful, please talk about the song In the Meantime.
In the Meantime is, I was at a writing retreat and we had to have 24 hours of silence and we had to go up a mountain and we had to look for something or ask for something, and I wanted a sign about a father that I didn't ever meet. And by the time I came down from the mountain, what I realized, and I was very disappointed up at the top because there was no clear sign that I got, but by the time I came down, I understood that everything I am is because of what I got and didn't get. And so, in a sense, the wound from his abandonment is also what gave me the understanding about abandonment and how to treat people. So that's what that song is about. And in the meantime, meaning here on Earth time, it's like, you know, that is the story of living, that you're going to learn from what you get and from what you don't get.
So many people are so broken, and this story is broken too. We go looking for forgiveness for things we did or didn't do. In our hearts, we know we're goodness. In our souls, we feel the call to be someone for somebody, each other, one and all. On the mountain, I have walked upon my knees. I have crawled along the rubble of broken
dreams and unmet needs. And the thing that I was looking for, and the thing I could not see, was the image of a perfect girl, the one I'd never be.
Tell me about the title track for Turning Into Beautiful.
I guess it's the same message that I've always been trying to get across, but in yet another way. It's like we can't love somebody until we can love ourselves. Sometimes we are easier on other people than we are on ourselves. And so there's this whole thing of turning into beautiful in the sense that, I mean, I've had it happen. People look at me, they think that I don't even mean it in a lover's sense. I just mean they value me more than I'm able to value myself. And sometimes I think the whole thing about, you know, stopping the disrespect we have for our children and just all the ways that we treat each other could be, it requires that we also feel better about ourselves. So that's what Turning Into Beautiful is about.
Learning to sense the love, learning to see the way, learning to trust and more often than not. Life is
was the song Turning Into Beautiful, and I'm down to the last song of the show. But before I get to it, I want to thank you all for listening, and I want to especially thank Farron for the wonderful interview. She's an artist I've been wanting to interview for quite some time, and the release of her new album provided the perfect opportunity. And as I knew would happen, the interview was so good that I could not fit all of it into the radio version of this show. So my internet listeners can hear an extended version with a lot more comments and additional music. That, of course, can be found at www.queermusicheritage.com. And as always, if you have questions or comments about any of the music I've featured, please write me at qmheritage@aol.com. This is J.D. Doyle for Queer Voices on KPFT Houston. For my closing song, I can't resist grabbing another track from the 1999 album Inside Out. That's the album with all the delicious cover versions of songs from the 60s. So here's my last question for Farron. Since I love songs that are lyrically gay, I just love how that worked out with My Girl.
Well, that was the other part of Inside Out, was that growing up a teenager, I didn't know that I was gay. I mean, I wasn't sexual in any way, but there was something that wasn't working out lyrically, and so it was really great all those years later that, like I said on the jacket, be able to go back and, you know, sing the song without changing the lyrics and have them be true.
On a cloudy day, and when it's cold outside, I got the month of May. I guess you'll say, what can make me feel this way?
Listening to J.D. Doyle's Queer Music Heritage, a feature presentation of Queer Voices. Queer Voices is heard each Monday at 7 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Networks station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles, and J.D. Doyle's Queer Music Heritage, which is produced in Houston. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, and Jack Valensky, with remote correspondents Joan Devlin in Iowa and David Elliott in Washington, D.C. For more information about guests, events, and organizations mentioned in the show, visit queervoices.org.
Some of the music you heard is listed or available on J.D. Doyle's website, queermusicheritage.org. Be sure to listen every Saturday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
Once every month for a year at the Rothko Chapel, teachers from 12 different religious faiths will share their contemplative traditions with participants during each meditation. Each presentation will offer participants the chance to learn more about a different tradition, observe it, and in many cases participate in the meditative practice. All are welcome to attend. This month's meditation will be held on June 13, 2006, from noon to 1 p.m. at the chapel. This month's focus is Christian and will be led by Carla Cooper. The meditation series is being offered in collaboration with the Jung Center of Houston, Interfaith Ministries of Greater Houston, and Ligminsha, Texas. To RSVP and to see additional dates for this series, please visit the website www.rothkochapel.org or call 713-524-9839. KPFT Houston.
Al Gore, the 45th Vice President of the United States, will appear on Wednesday, June 7th at the Hobby Center at 7:30. He will present a visually stunning multimedia presentation entitled Global Warming, an Inconvenient Truth. Copies of his new book...
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.